Second case this morning is Russ against Southwater Market. Mr. Dowd.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Peter Dowd. I represent the Chicago Area Pension and Severance Funds and not the union in this matter. The union was not a plaintiff in this case. The defendants tried to bring the union in at the end of discovery. The trial court denied that motion, but for the wrong reasons. Because it was at the end of discovery, because it would open up discovery, be prejudicial to the parties. The district court, however, tried the case as if it was a contract dispute under Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act. District court lost sight of the difference in the law where funds are the plaintiffs and they're suing under Section 515 of ERISA, lost sight of the court's binding precedent in the 1989 en banc decision in Gerber Truck Service. Gerber Truck precludes the trial court from failing to enforce a written agreement based upon an employer's contract formation defense.
Isn't that
defenses.
The question in this case, whether there was a written agreement?
There was
a writing, but it was signed by only one party.
This court's precedents say that a document does not have to be signed by the employer.
It doesn't have to be if the employer has assented in some other way. But unless I'm misunderstanding what happened, the question here was one of fact. Did the employer assent, either in writing or in some other way?
Well, there is no question that the employer had a copy of the memorandum. The memorandum's one page. The employer never objected, never told the funds that they objected to it. And for 2 years after the last collective bargaining negotiating session, they complied with that memorandum.
I thought the whole point of your suit was that they had not complied with the memorandum. They paid at the rates named in the memorandum, but not for the number of people.
Well,
they complied in part and not in part.
They paid on two full boat positions for 2 years until August of 2009. The last negotiating session took place in September of 2009. And the employer's representative, an attorney, had agreed that he would draft the collective bargaining agreement and that he would incorporate the terms agreed upon in September into a new contract. And for 5 months, he failed to do so, and the union's negotiator, Chuck Murdoch, 3 times in February said, could you please provide us with the contract? And on the last of those dates in February, he said the agreement required retroactive contributions to the severance fund back in November of 2007, and health coverage for the grocery workers beginning in January, and the funds are going to have to pursue a collection action if we don't get the information to the funds. And no response to that is provided by Abramson. Abramson said he would initially said he would respond ASAP, and then a month later in March, he said, I lost my notes. Could you please send me a list of what was agreed upon with respect to the grocery workers? And that's what generates the memorandum of agreement. So there's no disputed fact that the memorandum of agreement was provided to the funds. And under Gerber Truck and under the Banner Restoration cases, that's all the fact that's necessary. What was the fund provided? Now, this is a one-page document. This is not a UAW contract that could be 80 pages long. A five-minute exercise by the employer's negotiator, lawyer, could have been a response to say, no, we don't agree with the two full boat provision for the duration of the contract. But nothing like that occurs.
And the funds billed the employer pursuant to the terms of this writing.
That's right. And they had been billing for 16 months after that. And the employer paid the retroactive contribution amounts for the grocery workers. They paid the benefit increases provided for in the memorandum. And only in the trial before the trial court do they try to claim that they no longer agreed to those terms, and the negotiator tries to claim he never heard of the basis on which the driver's rates were going to be determined. And so what you have here is you have undisputed facts that there was a document provided to the benefit funds. And as with Transport and as with Banner, that's all that's required. And if there was an issue as to whether they agreed to that, the conduct of the employer on those eight terms is that for 2 years they complied with all of those terms. They never told the funds that there was any other agreement, that there was no agreement with respect to the two full boat provisions.
So what you have, wasn't there a stipulation in this litigation that there was an agreement? That the employer was bound?
The stipulations are with respect to the facts, that the memorandum was provided, that the memorandum was submitted to the funds, that the employer never submitted any objection to the memorandum after it was submitted to the funds in April of 2008. So the facts are stipulated, and in the motion for summary judgment, the district court rules that a reasonable jury could have concluded that there was no intent to cover a particular employee under this provision or to have two full boat provisions after one of the people retired. Now, under Gerber Truck and under the Banner Restoration decisions, that's not an appropriate issue for the court. This was a suit by the funds. This was not a contract dispute under Section 301.
Now, the reasoning behind the Gerber line of cases is that the funds are not part of the negotiation process and so have to rely on the agreement, which is presented in here. There was a member of the funds, Murdoch, who was part of the negotiation process. Do you think that makes a difference?
No, I don't think that makes a difference. Murdoch is not a sole trustee. Murdoch, in his position as a union negotiator, has other responsibilities. When he submits a document back to the funds, the Board of Trustees accepts that document and has responsibilities under Gerber Truck, under Section 515, to pursue amounts that are owed to the funds. So what happens when you get into this kind of litigation?
Is it normal for the trustees to accept agreements that are signed by only one side?
As indicated in the cases in the Seventh Circuit, it's not.
No,
that
I'm not asking about
normal.
The cases.
I'm
asking about the fund's practices.
Well, I can tell you that it's unusual that an employer doesn't respond if they have some disagreement, and it's normal that they sign an agreement.
I take it what you're saying is I don't know the answer.
No, I do know the answer because I'm fund counsel.
Please.
It is unusual for an employer not to respond if they disagree with something submitted to
no,
the funds.
No, it's not my question. Is it normal for the fund to accept a document signed by one side? The alternative is to go back and say, until both sides sign this agreement, nobody is participating in this plan. The fund do that?
I would say it's not normal. I would say that this is the exception. Many of the employers are under association agreements. Some of the employers sign an acceptance of the association agreement. Some don't. But this is an unusual case.
So SMS also says your reading of Gerber then could result in a union submitting a unilateral contract to the funds with no signature, and the funds would be able to start billing pursuant to that agreement.
Yes, except under Gerber Truck, if the employer had submitted a response, then that wouldn't have been the case. Here, a memorandum is submitted, and Murdoch wasn't trying to sandbag anybody. And he sent the email and he said, would you please acknowledge your agreement to this TA ASAP? And unfortunately,
I thought that was accompanied also by a statement that we're going to be going to the funds with this for billing purposes unless we hear otherwise.
He said the document was going there for billing purposes. He had said the month before that the fund was going to need to pursue collection actions if we don't provide them with something. He was asking the attorney negotiator for the fund to provide the document. He wasn't trying to pull a fast one. He sent the email. He asked for acknowledgement. He sent it to the funds. And there's nothing after that except compliance. All these changes in benefits, additional severance benefits, health coverage for the grocery workers, they all are put into place. So 7 out of 8 of these economic terms are all implemented, and the two full boat provision is complied with until somebody retires in August of 2009. So there is a document. There's no dispute that it was submitted, and there's no dispute that the employer never submitted an alternative document or indicated any opposition to it. And the compliance is absolutely clear for those 2 years after the last negotiating session. So what you end up with is contradictory positions taken by the trial court and taken by the defendants. The defendants have a judicial admission that there's a contract, and then they try to take the position that, well, that was the 2004 agreement with some oral agreements made in September of 2007. But they never asked for any further negotiations. And then they also take the position that, no, we didn't have an agreement. We just voluntarily complied with the pay provisions that we had agreed to previously. The trial court does the same thing. They rule that there is a judicial admission, that the trial court says that there was a complete agreement, but then they try the case as if it was a 301 action and say there was no final agreement. There was only voluntary compliance with the pay provisions. And under labor law, if there is no final agreement, there's no contract. So the trial court ends up with conflicting decisions that there is a judicial admission, there is a complete contract, but then its findings are totally implausible, that there was no agreement, but somehow there was an agreement that complied with 302C. I see I'm into my rebuttal time. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Certainly, Mr. Dow. Mr. Morris.
Good morning, Your Honor, Counsel. May it please the Court. My name is Hal Morris. I'm here on behalf of Southwater Market and William Steinbarth, accompanied by my two colleagues, Jennifer Crotchell and Megan Tone. I think the questions that the Court asked really focus the context that this case must be decided in. And the context it must be decided in is ERISA only permits...
Mr. Morris, if the document prepared by the union wasn't Southwater Market's contribution agreement, what was the basis for any contribution to the plan or participation by the workers in the plan?
There was a 2004 to 2007 agreement between the parties. That agreement then, on its own terms, based upon the union's request, was terminated and canceled because another agreement had not yet...
That's the basis of my question.
But that's what
continued. So if this new document wasn't an agreement, and the statute does require an agreement in writing, what was the basis of Southwater Market's participation in the plan at all?
That was the agreement. It was the 2000 as it was amended by the other pay provisions of their negotiations, which was what, in fact, Southwater paid. What is forgotten by the funds is that when they billed for the second full boat, Southwater, and the record supports this, objected on the bills that it did not owe that. The 2004 agreement between the union and Southwater.
When was the first objection?
On the first bill. And it continued throughout. What's important to note is that under the original 2004 collective bargaining agreement, the provision was that the second full boat would only stay in effect up until such time that one of the two drivers either retired or quit.
That's the sort of side agreement that doesn't get off the ground under Gerber Truck and but Transport.
Except it was not a side agreement. It was the written collective bargaining agreement. There is no side agreement here, and that's what's important to note.
The written collective bargaining agreement expired.
Yes.
And so that's off the table.
I'd suggest that
there either is this one-page memorandum of understanding or nothing.
I'd suggest that perhaps is not correct, Your Honor, is that it continued in effect under those terms while there was the continued
under
negotiations of the 2004 agreement. That's what Southwater
and the unions
did.
How could it continue in effect and expire at the same time?
It expired, but there was not a new one, just the terms went forward. That's how the union collected during the period of time from 04 to even the negotiating in September of 07, which was then when it finally broke down the negotiations. So I think that agreement was still, although it had been terminated, the terms were still in effect, and that was the writing as amended by what the parties agreed to. And I think that's the important part of this case, is that the funds suggest that what is agreed to between the employer and the union is irrelevant to the fund. But ERISA only permits the recovery of promised contributions. Here, Mr. Murdoch made very clear, as the negotiator for the union, that it was tentative, it was subject to revision. He asked for acknowledgement. He asked for precisely what Judge Easterbrook asked for. Do you get the signature? He didn't get those things. It never became final.
He didn't get any objection either.
Sure he did. He got an objection, number one, through the bills that they were objected to, and number two...
No, he got no objection before he submitted this to the funds. And the funds are entitled to take this writing at face value. That's what the Gerber Truck line of cases holds.
I would suggest that's not what Gerber Truck says in this context. Number one, what he said he was going to submit was for grocery workers. The second full boat is talking about drivers and warehousemen. Number two...
That's in the memorandum of understanding that he forwarded to the funds.
But that's all he said he was going to submit. His quote in February is, "I still have not heard from you. My notes show the severance fund contributions were due as of October of 07 and health and welfare fund contributions due as 1-108 for grocery workers." He didn't talk about drivers. And why didn't he? Because there wasn't an agreement. And then when they started billing for drivers, the second driver, that's when Southwater objected. As Judge Easterbrook asked, isn't it typical to have agreement from both parties? Mr. Murdoch recognized that. He specifically asked Mr. Abramson in his April communication to acknowledge your agreement. He never got that agreement, the district court found as a matter of fact, yet he went forward. He went forward then and says, when I step over the threshold of the fund's offices, I no longer know anything that I knew as union president, and I would submit that is incorrect. And that makes this significantly different than Gerber Truck. In Gerber Truck, it was jointly submitted by the union and by the employer.
If the employer objected, why did it pay for 2 years?
They only paid for that second full boat that under the 2004 agreement they would need to pay for until retirement. And then they stopped, just as they had agreed.
That's inconsistent, though, with an objection, which you just asserted was made.
No, no. They objected to the second full boat after the retirement.
Okay, that's too late. That's 2 years down the road. But they made no contemporaneous objection at the time of the billing for two full years, or almost 2 years.
What they objected to, that was the billing for the second full boat.
That objection came later at the retirement, if that's what you're referring to as the objection. Was there an objection before that?
Yes.
When?
When they never agreed to a second...
Okay, no. I'm asking for an affirmative objection. Was there ever an affirmative objection, either at the time that Murdoch was circulating this document?
During the September 2007 bargaining session.
Okay, now I'm talking about at the time that this writing... Because the only thing that's relevant for ERISA purposes is the writing and whether the fund was entitled to take the writing at face value. So was there an objection contemporaneous with this writing?
There was never an acceptance. Was there an affirmative
objection?
Was there
an objection?
There wasn't an objection.
No. And it didn't come until 2 years later after they had been paying on both positions.
That's not, as a matter of fact, as the district court found, I would disagree with Your Honor characterizing it that way. What the district court found based upon the evidence is that, yes, there was never an agreement. And whether you say
was
no.
Was there an objection?
I would submit that by saying I do not agree.
This can't be analyzed as, with the full... availability of all contract defenses.
No, it can't be. But here, where there's not an agreement, to say you didn't object is the same as saying I'm not agreeing to it. And Mr. Murdoch asked for that agreement and never received it. Yet he went ahead when he was at those meetings knowing that he had characterized this as tentative, as subject to revision, as requiring looking at someone else's notes, yet went forward.
Those subjective intentions don't matter from the standpoint of the funds.
They do.
They accept the document that's given to them, and they bill based on it.
But Mr. Murdoch is also in the fund. He's not just the union saying,
that
here,
fund. That doesn't make a difference.
I think it does, Your Honor, because otherwise he can say, or anyone can say, I wear this hat today. When I step over the threshold, everything else I knew can be forgotten. And I'd submit that is not an appropriate view of the law. Here, Mr. Murdoch knew what he had represented about this agreement, yet went to the funds where he was a member of the Board of Trustees and the chairman and said, enforce it anyways, even though I told the employer it was tentative. And that is incorrect and that is wrong,
yes,
I would submit.
Yes, and after it was tentative, the employer paid.
But once again...
They paid for 2 years till the full boat guy left.
But was because of the prior agreement is why they were paying and why the fund continued to accept it. Once that occurred, it occurred exactly the way that 2004 agreement suggested it should. You stop paying for it. There was never a suggestion during these negotiations with the union, and no evidence before the district court to suggest otherwise, that South Water was ever agreeing to anything other than what was in the 2004 agreement. They were never agreeing to a second full boat. And I'd submit to the court that under the Gerber trucking decision, that's a jointly submitted to the fund to rely upon. Here we don't have a joint submission. We have a unilateral submission.
There was a unilateral submission in the transport case.
No, I think the quote actually is that the documents specifically were submitted by the employer and by the union.
I thought it was by the union only.
And that's because they saw the documents as being in order, the fund. But here the fund could not see the documents as being appropriately in order, because Mr. Murdoch is also the person at the fund side saying, I know that this is tentative. I know this is subject to agreement. It's very different, I would suggest, than Gerber. It's also very different, I would suggest, than Banner. Because in Banner, I think what the court looked at, the district court, is was there a course of conduct? And that's a question of fact. And the district court made that question of fact determination that there was not a course of conduct, as this court suggests, to find that there was agreement, to even if you suggest the MOA or the memorandum is the writing. And that would be a clear error standard of review. And I'd suggest that after a trial on the merits, the district court did not clearly err in that respect. That decision, Banner, stands for a proposition specifically that the court effectively makes a decision based on the facts. Here, the district court made that decision based on the facts. Whether the district court said the word Banner, said the word Gerber truck is irrelevant, is did it apply the principles? And I would suggest to the court that it did provide the principles. That leaves us really at the issue where the plaintiffs or the funds argued is that it should have been the burden of South Water to prove what the agreement was. First off, in those burden-shifting cases, when this court has looked at them, there was already evidence produced as to what an agreement said. And that's what's missing here, is that there's no evidence as to what the agreement said. There's simply, here's a tentative draft of an agreement. Even if you believe it existed, the district court made factual determinations that said there was not such a course of conduct, and because there was not such a course of conduct, there was not an agreement for a second full boat. I'd suggest to this court that it is appropriate to affirm the district court because it surely was not clearly erroneous. It established at the summary judgment stage the tribal issue, and the funds chose to ignore the tribal issue. When it decided that tribal issue as to whether there was an agreement the funds could appropriately rely upon, it found, as a matter of fact, there was not. And as such, we suggest...
I'm looking in the district court's opinion for this, these factual findings that you're asserting the court made, and I don't see that the court analyzed this as a case of assent manifested by conduct. This is a basic sort of meeting of the minds, contract formation.
I think to the contrary. I think what the court looked at, it looked at the prior agreement. It looked at the negotiations. It heard all the testimony. There's nothing to suggest that
the court didn't make
that.
any findings or refer to any law about this manifestation of assent by conduct and the whole, 2 years of payment issue.
I think it heard the testimony, and with respect to its decision, I think it's appropriate, unless there's clear error on the court's part, to say that it knows the law and it considered the law. And I would submit to the court, this court, that is exactly what Judge Guzman
There's no evidence
did.
That the court considered that law, or that the court considered the Gerber truck line of cases about how to appropriately frame the issue.
No, I think there is. I think although those cases are not cited, the principles are nevertheless addressed by the court.
Where? They're just not there.
No, I think it does address it. I think it addresses those principles to the extent that it looks at the factual circumstances under which the so-called agreement was reached, how it was then performed afterwards. It heard all the evidence, and it made a determination as a matter of fact that there was not such an agreement in place. And that's just the factual agreement or the factual inquiry that both Gerber and Banner seek to have done. So with that, we would ask the court to affirm the district court's finding is certainly not clearly erroneous.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Dowd?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, I apologize. My answer was probably incorrect about whether it was uncommon to have a memorandum of agreement that was unsigned. Mr. Murdoch testified during the trial that it was not uncommon to have an unsigned memorandum of agreement.
You realize that the phrase not uncommon has no meaning whatsoever.
Well, he said it was common in his trial testimony. I wasn't the trial attorney,
okay.
And I apologize for getting
it
wrong.
Don't have any meaning.
The basis for the contributions that the defendants claim the 2004 does not meet the requirements of 302C5 or 515. They shift back and forth between 204 and they talk about verbal agreement, and at no time did they ever say what that verbal agreement was. The tentative agreement concept, I submit to you, even Mr. Abramson, the attorney and negotiator, in the transcript at 525 testifies that a TA was an agreement between the parties, and it was the agreement if it was ratified. And there's no dispute that that agreement was ratified in this case. The one case that they submit that a TA, or tentative agreement, is not sufficient is a labor board case, Glasser versus Heartland Healthcare Center. And in that case, the court determines that if it's ratified, then a tentative agreement is binding, and it is the contract. So what they're trying to do is focus on tentative and ignore the fact that it's an agreement, and that during the negotiating process, the parties sign off on what's been agreed upon, and then when you get them all together and you get a final agreement, it has to be ratified by the employees for it to be the complete agreement. And there's nothing inconsistent in Chuck Murdoch's conduct here as both a union negotiator and as the trustee, and the trial court found no inconsistency. He believed it was a final agreement between the parties. He disclosed it in the email. He wrote it out in a typed document. He didn't slip this under the door of the funds. He sent it to Abramson, and he asked Abramson to acknowledge that that was the case. And in this case, as in transport, the company left it to the union. The company knew the memorandum of agreement was being submitted, and they had the opportunity to say, no, that's not the agreement. Now, the testimony in the trial is that when Abramson got this, he said, oh, I considered him crazy. He must have been smoking dope. Well, there were eight provisions in there, and seven of them were either costly to the funds or significant change in the wages and benefits. They complied with all of those without objection. Wage increases were put into effect in 08 and 09. Health benefits were provided to grocery workers. Severance benefits retroactive to October of 2007. So how crazy could Mr. Murdoch have been? How plausible is it? If it was appropriate for the court to consider these factual issues about a contract dispute, we submit that the conclusions of the trial court are totally implausible, that this could not have gone down this way, not with a negotiator who's an attorney who knows that a tentative agreement, if it's ratified, is the contract between the parties. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.